That was Florence and the Machine and her song You've Got the Love. It is 12 p.m. noon here on Saturday, August 4th. This is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And of course, you can stream us online at weft.org. This is the world we live in, and I'm your host, Ben Theobald. And this past week was a bit quite eventful in terms of what's going on in politics and with the this past week with President Donald Trump, of course, making headlines as he tweeted as he of course, as he usually does, as he makes a way of his communication with the American public. He tweeted his made his displeasure with Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and specifically, this was President Donald Trump's tweet, quote, "This is a terrible situation, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt," referring to the Russia investigation that's being headed by Robert Mueller, the head of the investigation. This is a terrible situation. Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop the rigged witch hunt right now before it continues to stain our country any further, Trump tweeted. Bob Mueller is totally conflicted, and the 17 angry Democrats that are doing his dirty work are a disgrace to USA. Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt right now. So that was a tweet that President Trump sent a few days ago, kind of showing his displeasure with his attorney general, who has recused himself from the Russia investigation that's, as I said, being headed by special counsel Robert Mueller. And of course, President Donald Trump's campaign manager is currently on trial for his involvement with Russian officials. And he's on trial right now. That's going into that went to its fourth day of trial. And I wanted to now, coincidentally, or view this however you might, tomorrow, which is August 5th, marks the anniversary of, August 5th, 1974, U.S. President Richard Nixon admitted that he had withheld information about the Watergate break-in, and of course, as you know, with Watergate, it eventually led to President Richard Nixon's resigning in resigning the U.S. presidency. And wanted to play one of his Richard Nixon's speeches that he gave on Watergate. He actually gave a series of speeches on the Watergate, addressing basically from his perspective of the Watergate issue, and I wanted to play that for you to kind of give you an idea of what was going on back in those days with that scandal. And this is played from, in case if I forget, after I finish the video, YouTuber Closed Caption Zone YouTube channel. So my thanks to him or her for having this video up.
Good evening. I want to talk to you tonight from my heart on a subject of deep concern to every American. In recent months, members of my administration and officials of the Committee for the Re-election of the President, including some of my closest friends, and most trusted aides have been charged with involvement in what has come to be known as the Watergate affair. These include charges of illegal activity during and preceding the 1972 presidential election, and charges that responsible officials participated in efforts to cover up that illegal activity. The inevitable result of these charges has been to raise serious questions about the integrity of the White House itself. Tonight, I wish to address those questions. Last June 17, while I was in Florida trying to get a few days' rest after my visit to Moscow, I first learned from news reports of the Watergate break-in. I was appalled at this senseless, illegal action. And I was shocked to learn that employees of the re-election committee were apparently among those guilty. I immediately ordered an investigation by appropriate government authorities. On September 15, as you'll recall, indictments were brought against 7 defendants in the case. As the investigations went forward, I repeatedly asked those conducting the investigation whether there was any reason to believe that members of my administration were in any way involved. I received repeated assurances that there were not. Because of these continuing reassurances, because I believed the reports I was getting, because I had faith in the persons from whom I was getting them, I discounted the stories in the press that appeared to implicate members of my administration or other officials of the campaign committee. Until March of this year, I remained convinced that the denials were true and that the charges of involvement by members of the White House staff were false. The comments I made during this period, the comments made by my press secretary in my behalf, were based on the information provided to us at the time we made those comments. However, new information then came to me, which persuaded me that there was a real possibility that some of these charges were true, and suggesting further that there had been an effort to conceal the facts, both from the public, from you, and from me. As a result, on March 21st, I personally assumed the responsibility for coordinating intensive new inquiries into the matter, and I personally ordered those conducting the investigations to get all the facts and to report them directly to me right here in this office. I again ordered that all persons in the government or at the re-election committee should cooperate fully with the FBI, the prosecutors, and the grand jury. I also ordered that anyone who refused to cooperate in telling the truth would be asked to resign from government service. And with ground rules adopted that would preserve the basic constitutional separation of powers between the Congress and the presidency, I directed that members of the White House staff should appear and testify voluntarily under oath before the Senate committee, which was investigating Watergate. I was determined that we should get to the bottom of the matter and that the truth should be fully brought out, no matter who was involved. At the same time, I was determined not to take precipitate action and to avoid, if at all possible, any action that would appear to reflect on innocent people. I wanted to be fair, but I knew that in the final analysis, the integrity of this office, public faith in the integrity of this office, would have to take priority over all personal considerations. Today, in one of the most difficult decisions of my presidency, I accepted the resignations of 2 of my closest associates in the White House, Bob Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, 2 of the finest public servants it has been my privilege to know. I want to stress that in accepting these resignations, I mean to leave no implication, whatever, of personal wrongdoing on their part. And I leave no implication tonight of implication on the part of others who have been charged in this matter. But in matters as sensitive as guarding the integrity of our democratic process, it is essential not only that rigorous legal and ethical standards be observed, but also that the public, you, have total confidence that they are both being observed and enforced by those in authority, and particularly by the President of the United States. They agreed with me that this move was necessary in order to restore that confidence. Because Attorney General Kleindienst, though a distinguished public servant, my personal friend for 20 years, with no personal involvement whatever in this matter, has been a close personal and professional associate of some of those who are involved in this case, he and I both felt that it was also necessary to name a new Attorney General. The counsel to the President, John Dean, has also resigned. As the new Attorney General, I have today named Elliot Richardson, a man of unimpeachable integrity and rigorously high principle. I have directed him to do everything necessary to ensure that the Department of Justice has the confidence and the trust of every law-abiding person in this country. I have given him absolute authority to make all decisions bearing upon the prosecution of the Watergate case and related matters. I have instructed him that if he should consider it appropriate, he has the authority to name a special supervising prosecutor for matters arising out of the case. Whatever may appear to have been the case before, whatever improper activities may yet be discovered in connection with this whole sordid affair, I want the American people, I want you, to know beyond the shadow of a doubt that during my term as president, justice will be pursued fairly, fully, and impartially, no matter who is involved. This office is a sacred trust, and I am determined to be worthy of that trust. Looking back at the history of this case, two questions arise. How could it have happened? Who is to blame? Political commentators have correctly observed that during my 27 years in politics, I've always previously insisted on running my own campaigns for office. But 1972 presented a very different situation. In both domestic and foreign policy, 1972 was a year of crucially important decisions, of intense negotiations, of vital new directions, particularly in working toward the goal which has been my overriding concern throughout my political career, the goal of bringing peace to America, peace to the world. And that is why I decided, as the 1972 campaign approached, that the presidency should come first and politics second. To the maximum extent possible, therefore, I sought to delegate campaign operations, to remove the day-to-day campaign decisions from the president's office and from the White House. I also, as you recall, severely limited the number of my own campaign appearances. Who then is to blame for what happened in this case? For specific criminal actions by specific individuals, those who committed those actions must, of course, bear the liability and pay the penalty. For the fact that alleged improper actions took place within the White House or within my campaign organization, the easiest course would be for me to blame those to whom I delegated the responsibility to run the campaign. But that would be a cowardly thing to do. I will not place the blame on subordinates, on people whose zeal exceeded their judgment, and who may have done wrong in a cause they deeply believe to be right. In any organization, the man at the top must bear the responsibility. That responsibility, therefore, belongs here, in this office. I accept it. And I pledge to you tonight from this office that I will do everything in my power to ensure that the guilty are brought to justice and that such abuses are purged from our political processes in the years to come, long after I have left this office. Some people, quite properly appalled at the abuses that occurred, will say that Watergate demonstrates the bankruptcy of the American political system. I believe precisely the opposite is true. Watergate represented a series of illegal acts and bad judgments by a number of individuals. It was the system that has brought the facts to light and that will bring those guilty to justice. A system that in this case has included a determined grand jury, honest prosecutors, a courageous judge, John Sirica, and a vigorous free press. It is essential now that we place our faith in that system, and especially in the judicial system. It is essential that we let the judicial process go forward, respecting those safeguards that are established to protect the innocent as well as to convict the guilty. It is essential that in reacting to the excesses of others, we not fall into excesses ourselves. It is also essential that we not be so distracted by events such as this that we neglect the vital work before us, before this nation, before America, at a time of critical importance to America and the world. Since March, when I first learned that the Watergate affair might in fact be far more serious than I had been led to believe, it has claimed far too much of my time and my attention. Whatever may now transpire in the case, whatever the actions of the grand jury, whatever the outcome of any eventual trials, I must now turn my full intention, and I shall do so once again, to the larger duties of this office. I owe it to this great office that I hold, and I owe it to you, to my country. I know that as Attorney General, Elliot Richardson will be both fair and he will be fearless in pursuing this case wherever it leads. I am confident that with him in charge, justice will be done. There is vital work to be done toward our goal of a lasting structure of peace in the world. Work that cannot wait. Work that I must do. Tomorrow, for example, Chancellor Brown of West Germany will visit the White House for talks that are a vital element of the Year of Europe, as 1973 has been called. We are already preparing for the next Soviet-American summit meeting later this year. This is also a year in which we are seeking to negotiate a mutual and balanced reduction of armed forces in Europe, which will reduce our defense budget and allow us to have funds for other purposes at home so desperately needed. It is the year when the United States and Soviet negotiators will seek to work out the second an even more important round of our talks on limiting nuclear arms and of reducing the danger of a nuclear war that would destroy civilization as we know it. It is a year in which we confront the difficult tasks of maintaining peace in Southeast Asia and in the potentially explosive Middle East. There's also vital work to be done right here in America to ensure prosperity. And that means a good job for everyone who wants to work, to control inflation that I know worries every housewife, everyone who tries to balance a family budget in America, to set in motion new and better ways of ensuring progress toward a better life for all Americans. When I think of this office, of what it means, I think of all the things that I want to accomplish for this nation, of all the things I want to accomplish for you. On Christmas Eve, during my terrible personal ordeal of the renewed bombing of North Vietnam, which after 12 years of war finally helped to bring America peace with honor, I sat down just before midnight. I wrote out some of my goals for my second term as president. Let me read them to you. To make it possible for our children and for our children's children to live in a world of peace. To make this country be more than ever a land of opportunity, of equal opportunity, full opportunity for every American. To provide jobs for all who can work and generous help for those who cannot work. To establish a climate of decency and civility in which each person respects the feelings and the dignity and the God-given rights of his neighbor. To make this a land in which each person can dare to dream, can live his dreams, not in fear but in hope, proud of his community, proud of his country, proud of what America has meant to himself and to the world. These are great goals. I believe we can, we must work for them. We can achieve them. But we cannot achieve these goals unless we dedicate ourselves to another goal. We must maintain the integrity of the White House. And that integrity must be real, not transparent. There can be no whitewash at the White House. We must reform our political process, ridding it not only of the violations of the law, but also of the ugly mob violence and other inexcusable campaign tactics that have been too often practiced and too readily accepted in the past, including those that may have been a response by one-sided to the excesses or expected excesses of the other side. Two wrongs do not make a right. I've been in public life for more than a quarter of a century. Like any other calling, politics has good people and bad people. And let me tell you, the great majority in politics, in the Congress, in the federal government, in the state government, are good people. I know that it can be very easy, under the intensive pressures of a campaign, for even well-intentioned people to fall into shady tactics. To rationalize this on the grounds that what is at stake is of such importance to the nation that the end justifies the means. And both of our great parties have been guilty of such tactics in the past. In recent years, however, the campaign excesses that have occurred on all sides have provided a sobering demonstration of how far this false doctrine can take us. The lesson is clear. America, in its political campaigns, must not again fall into the trap of letting the end, however great that end is, justify the means. I urge the leaders of both political parties, I urge citizens, all of you everywhere, to join in working toward a new set of standards, new rules and procedures to ensure that future elections will be as nearly free of such abuses as they possibly can be made. This is my goal. I ask you to join in making it America's goal. When I was inaugurated for a second term this past January 20th, I gave each member of my cabinet and each member of my senior White House staff a special four-year calendar with each day marked to show the number of days remaining to the administration. In the inscription on each calendar, I wrote these words: "The presidential term which begins today consists of 1,461 days, no more, no less. Each can be a day of strengthening and renewal for America. Each can add depth and dimension to the American experience. If we strive together, if we make the most of the challenge and the opportunity that these days offer us, they can stand out as great days for America and great moments in the history of the world." I looked at my own calendar this morning up at Camp David as I was working on this speech. It showed exactly 1,361 days remaining in my term. I want these to be the best days in America's history. Because I love America, I deeply believe that America is the hope of the world. And I know that in the quality and wisdom of the leadership America gives lies the only hope for millions of people all over the world, that they can live their lives in peace and freedom. We must be worthy of that hope in every sense of the word. Tonight, I ask for your prayers to help me in everything that I do throughout the days of my presidency to be worthy of their hopes and of yours. God bless America, and God bless each and every one of you.
And again, that was President Richard Nixon in his first Watergate speech that he gave in April 30th, 1973. He gave, I believe, four of these speeches, and of course eventually had to resign because of he was eventually going to be impeached if he didn't, and so in 1974. And just let you know, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. And I'll get into some public service announcements. The art theater listings for this week or weekend and week. Screening daily is the Sundance Sundance Film Festival hit three identical strangers. The documentary's storyline concerns triplets who were separated at birth and then coincidentally reunite, but together discover the dark truth about their origin. And also playing is Damsel, which will have four screenings. The movie revolves around an affluent pioneer who ventures across the American frontier to marry the love of his life, Penelope. As they traverse the lawless frontier, their journey grows treacherous and the lines between hero, villain, and damsel are blurred. And the weekend 10 p.m. movie, also screening on Wednesday and Thursday at 9:45 p.m., is Ghost Stories, which follows a professor who devotes his life to exposing phony physics. He is put to the test when he receives news of three chilling and inexplicable cases that seem to have a sinister connection to the professor's own life. And then on Tuesday, August 7th, at 7:30 p.m., you'll have a chance to take a trip with the Beatles on their Yellow Submarine. The film will be screened in its 4K restoration in celebration of the 50th anniversary of its release. And then finally, Minding the Gap will play on Wednesday, August 8th at 7:30 p.m. This story concerns three young men who escape volatile families in their Rust Belt hometown. And of course, for all up-to-date times, you can go to the Art Theater's website at www.theartheater.org. And let's go, this past week, or actually tomorrow, I believe it's the Voting Rights Act's anniversary, or it's when it became effective. Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was a landmark piece of federal legislation in the United States that prohibited racial discrimination in voting, that became effective on August 6th, 1965, enacted by the 89th United States Congress. And this is a speech that President Lyndon Johnson gave on the Voting Rights Act.
The Constitution is plain. There is no moral issue. It is wrong, deadly wrong, to deny any of your fellow Americans the right to vote in this country. There is no issue of states' rights or national rights. There is only the struggle for human rights. I have not the slightest doubt what will be your answer. But the last time a president sent a civil rights bill to the Congress, it contained a provision to protect voting rights in federal elections. That civil rights bill was passed after 8 long months of debate. And when that bill came to my desk from the Congress for my signature, the heart of the voting provision had been eliminated. This time, on this issue, there must be no delay or no hesitation or no compromise with our purpose. We cannot, we must not, refuse to protect the right of every American to vote in every election that he may desire to participate in. And we ought not, and we cannot, and we must not wait another 8 months before we get a bill. We have already waited 100 years and more, and the time for waiting is gone. I ask you to join me in working long hours, nights, and weekends if necessary, to pass this bill. And I don't make that request lightly. Far from the window where I sit with the problems of our country, I recognize that from outside this chamber is the outraged conscience of a nation, the grave concern of many nations, and the harsh judgment of history on our acts. But even if we pass this bill, the battle will not be over. What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really, it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
And I would like to thank the KXAN that was on their YouTube channel, KXAN TV, and I believe they're in a NBC affiliate station in Austin, Texas. So thank you to them for having that available on YouTube for me to use. And tomorrow will also mark the anniversary of a march that Dr. Martin Luther King held in Chicago. I believe it was 1966, and this is just some of that march.
To launch a series of marches into all white suburbs, by moving north and by concerning itself with equality in housing and employment, the civil rights movement began to encounter increased resistance, the so-called white backlash. And other demonstrators were struck by bricks and bottles.
How do you feel about this reception?
Well, this is a terrible thing. I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen here in Chicago.
The march will go on anyway?
Oh, very definitely. We can't stop the march. We've been going on a few minutes.
You feel you're in a close society, Dr. King, here in the Southwest side?
Oh, yes. It's definitely a closed society, and we're going to make it an open society. And we feel that we have to do it this way in order to bring the evil out into the open.
That was apologies about the audio. It was a bit hard to hear, I know, but that was. I'll give thanks though to YouTube channel My Footage 0001 for having that available. Unfortunately, the audio wasn't a bit hard to hear, but it's kind of unfortunate. August 2nd, and this is kind of a whole time. Actually, I have one more PSA announce, public service announcement I need to make. The Urbana Park District offers people age 50 and up the chance to meet for fun and educational programs. The Urbana Park District Cessier Club meets monthly at Phillips Recreation Center. People can eat lunch followed by a program. The senior club takes several trips a year, and there are chances for seniors to drop in for free health checks and participate in different activities. For more information, you can call the Urbana Park District at 217-367-1544. And August 2nd marked the birthday of acclaimed African-American author James Baldwin. I want to play a speech that he gave. I believe this was in 1963. This was a speech he gave in Harlem. And I would like to thank the Post Archive YouTube channel, before I forget, for having this audio available. So thank you to that person.
Reason that such people capable of turning hoses on children and dogs on children should not be allowed to live, to lead anonymous, everyday, just home folks, lives. Now this has had this effort, the American effort, which is essentially an effort to deny its past. To deny its past, I mean two things by that. I mean that, for example, we were talking about myths a little while ago. I said we made a myth out of our history. And for example, most white Americans still seem to believe, in fact, as far as I know, do believe, that they all sprang from a race of freedom-loving heroes and martyrs and pilgrims. And everybody came here because they had unquenchable thirst for freedom. And we say this very seriously, as though we never heard of the history of Europe. I never heard, for example, of the potato famine in Ireland, which drove the Irish here. They wanted potatoes, not freedom. The only person who ever came here who never meant to do it is me. The European assumption was that these people were inferior. And that depends, I think, on a very simple principle. They had to be inferior. If they were not inferior, it was a crime. But as long as they didn't deserve any better, it was all right. And that is the whole basis of the whole legend of Negro inferiority. That is why there's really no reason, to try to defend oneself against someone who says, but you all have so much syphilis. And you didn't steal fire. You didn't invent the wheel. First of all, nobody knows who stole the fire or who got the wheel. That's another lie. And that's not the point. I don't have to have stolen the fire or have invented the wheel to have the right to walk around in my lifetime like a man. One can't defend oneself against somebody who is determined to prove to himself, not to you, but to himself, that you are inferior and wants you to corroborate it. One's got to walk out of that nightmare. But the demoralization, which is now overtaken, or is about to overtake, can overtake the Western world, is seen in great relief. The end of that journey is seen in the face of Jamie Moore, for example, in Birmingham. It is seen in the faces of all the Alabama sheriffs and in most of the New York cops. They really don't know They're not even really wicked. That would be all right, even. You can deal with a wicked man. But they really don't know. They've deluded themselves that I was happy on the levee. That all that singing and dancing, all that singing of the blues, all that teeth. No. They thought I was happy. Now they knew that if they had been in my place, they wouldn't have been happy. And I know they knew that. There's one thing every man, everybody, every human being knows about another human being. Every man of a bone, no matter what he does about it, knows. He recognizes, cannot help but recognize, another man. He knows he's not a monkey, for example. This is a man. And men strike echoes in each other. Human beings strike echoes in each other, on which they depend in order to live at all. Now, if you find yourself in a position where you must deny and make a system out of denying the manhood of another, you have simply emasculated yourself. That is one aspect of what I mean by demoralization. And I confess it is sometimes very hard to remember when you're in the precinct basement or when you're dealing with all these people, and not only the precinct basement, when you're at a literary cocktail party. And somebody says to you, for example, if I may ramble on just a few more minutes, somebody you've known for years, you know, and someone who is, let us say, in your profession, by which I mean one of your peers, and someone who is not a racist, even, at all, has invited you for dinner at his house on a certain place at 8 o'clock. Dinner and cocktails and a few friends. And if you're me, you know, you're always a little late. But in any case, you've got to get a taxi to get there. And I'm sure that I'm not the only person who is aware that it is sometimes very difficult when the sun goes down to get a taxi. So you evolve all kinds of systems to beat this system. And there's always one taxi driver who has the presence of mind to lock his door from the inside, who has to stop for the light. And you get in. As it turns out, you are not going tonight to 125th Street. Which you don't tell him. For a while. No. All you tell him is, you drive me where I'm going, or to the police station. All right, and he finally takes you to where you're going, which turns out to be a certain place. Whereupon he, of course, is having something resembling a stroke. Like, what are you doing there without a package? This is in 1963. So you arrive at your host, your liberal host's home, understandably a little frayed, a little tired, you know, and you're still trying to be a gentleman, you know, and you ask the cat to give you a double scotch, and he says, what's the matter, Jimmy? And you say one of several things, and by and by I come down. And then what you're told is, my God, Jimmy, you're so bitter. And then, of course, you'd like to kill him, you know. You really do feel for a minute with friends like these, and you know the rest of the phrase, I hope. Who needs enemies? But he's not being wicked. He really doesn't know. And what he doesn't understand about the assumptions he betrays are that he really thinks, he really somewhere at the very bottom of his heart, stomach, must believe that because you can call a taxi and come to a certain place, everything's all right. That was what you wanted. And it always occurs to me that must be what he wanted. Because when I was a little boy, I never heard of a certain place. They don't understand where reality is. When someone says, what does the Negro want? I'm always thrown. Because I know that I know what he wants. I know what anybody I'm dealing with wants, you know, more or less. I know that they don't want to be in jail. They don't want to be tortured. They want to raise their children. They want what everybody else wants. And someone says, what about intermarriage? What about miscegenation? You have to look at him again. He's not talking about miscegenation at all. He's talking about black men. He's talking about black men. It's not miscegenation. It was a white man doing it. It's miscegenation if I'm doing it. And that, if I may say so, says vastly more about the man who asked the question than it does about me. Now, I went to school here. I mean, when I say here now, I mean America. And it was impossible for me, when I was a school child, to understand anything about my own history, about my own past, because it wasn't in the textbook. This really means, that if my history wasn't in the textbooks, nobody else's was either. And I mean that until today. Americans don't know their history, and history is not something you study. History is something you achieve. You've got to know what happened if you intend to make another move. And Americans don't know what happened. Not yet. I beg you then to think in the same context of an extraordinary movie called The Defiant One. Remember the music. Who, of course, falls in love with Tony. Now, they've both been on the road for a long time, you know, dodging tsetse flies and things. No. And as far as you can tell from looking at the screen, they're both men, you know. But Sydney doesn't seem to need a woman. Tony goes into the bedroom, if I remember this movie correctly. I think I remember the music. And Sydney stays in the kitchen because he's too tired. Well, you know, luckily I didn't write that movie. But I suppose it consoled the man who wrote it and all the white people who saw it. And only has one terrible flaw. It isn't true in any way whatever. It isn't true about people. And it isn't true about history. Blacks and whites have been chained together in Mississippi for a very long time. And so far as I can tell, they've not yet learned to love each other. What I want is that one do two things at once. That one recognize and rejoice in and utilize the fact that one is black or beige or brown or whatever. That one is legally in this country a Negro. Okay, crazy. That one understand, profoundly understand, that I, speaking now as a Negro, I did not invent the nigger. I never needed him. It was not my trauma. I didn't suddenly wake up and say, oh my God, I'm black. I never cared until I realized how many other people cared that my nose was flat, my mouth was big, and my hair was kinky, my skin was dark. That didn't bother me, baby, until somebody called me nigger. And then, of course, since I was born in America, I had to watch those people very carefully, and it cost me something, and it has cost us all something, and for a very long time, to step out of that standard of judgment and realize that it's their problem. They invented it. I never needed it. I always knew that I was a man. The country never did. And the cries of anguish one hears now are involved mainly with the fact that now, for the first time in our history, they are beginning to suspect that fact. That they invented the nigger because they needed him. And now they're beginning uncertainly to wonder why and what can they do about it. And of course, there ain't much time to do anything. One, I said before, that every man born knows when he meets another man. Every man born knows that. Now, if that's so, and all these crimes have been committed because you said he wasn't a man, and now by 1963, these crimes are being committed in the name of the bulk of the white population, it's a terrible crisis. Have to go back and think about it and recognize that what you are accusing this man of, like he's a rapist, he carries a knife, you know, you can't trust him, he's lazy, or conversely, he's a saint, so don't worry about him. All these things were inventions. White people invented this creation because they needed it. I'm not going to keep you much longer, but I want to spell this out a little bit, just one more time.
Unfortunately, I have to end that speech right there as it's getting to the end of the hour, so it's the end. I have to wrap my show up, but I would highly advise you, if you can, to listen to the whole James Baldwin speech that he gave in Harlem. I would like to thank, again, the Post Archive YouTube channel for having that speech available. And if you haven't checked out the WFT events calendar yet, you may want to. It gives you all the information about meetings, fundraisers, and other activities. Members and the general public are always welcome to any WFT events, so be sure to check us out. You can go to weft.org and click on the events tab on the right side of the page. And that will be it for my show, The World We Live In. I am going to play a song by Patti Smith and from her album, I believe it's Patti Smith Gung Ho, and the track is Messengers. I believe that's the track. I'm just going to go with that. So yes, this is Patti Smith. Enjoy the rest of your day.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls.